the fifth case of the morning. Is that Ms. Mullen saying goodbye? Okay. This case is appeal number 08-1095, United States versus Dion Lake. And we have Mr. Schwing.
Again, Your Honors. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. Mr. Lake was in the process of pleading guilty to a controlled substances offense when his attorney alerted the court to what he believed to be a conflict of interest. He had a shared office space, secretarial support, and so forth with an attorney who had or was representing a witness or a potential witness against Mr. Lake. That client was named George Taylor. Now, Mr. Lake's attorney is a really a stand-up guy, and he alerted the court. He said, I think I have a problem here, Your Honor. I've seen some correspondence, and I think I have a conflict of interest, and I'd like to be relieved, let out of the case. And there was a telephone hearing at which Mr. Lake was not present, and the court was assured that George Platinum Taylor was not going to be called as a witness by the government. And with those assurances and others, the court said, no, you don't have a conflict. Well, in point of fact, Platinum Taylor was, in effect, called as a witness, although he wasn't there in person. There were some, in the pre-sentence report, there were a number of people that were cited as customers of Mr. Lake's. And at oral argument, the prosecution talked about George Taylor, said George Taylor was essentially the delivery service in a lot of these drug deals, and kind of hooked George Taylor in with a number of other people that were involved in drug sales involving Mr. Lake. There are a couple things that are problematic about that. One of them is George Taylor.
I just want to be clear. You want a new sentencing hearing?
Yes.
You're not asking to withdraw your guilty plea?
No.
So you go back. I thought that you got a very reasonable call in your favor, in your client's favor, on the amount of drugs that were involved here. Less than 1.5 kilos when the evidence seemed to support significantly more. I just don't see any indication that you'd be better off if you went back for a new sentencing hearing here, considering that you got pretty much of a break on the amount of drugs.
Well, he did get a break on the amount of drugs. That's true. But we have another argument that the sentence here is unreasonable, and I'd like to talk about that for a minute. Maybe that'll help address Your Honor's concerns. Mr. Lake pleaded guilty to an offense involving 1/10 of a gram of crack. That was the offense of conviction. 1/10 of a gram of crack. He was sentenced as though, or the same as somebody who had distributed or pleaded guilty to an offense involving 1,499 grams of crack. And to kind of put this in perspective, suppose I had gone into court in Illinois and pleaded guilty to stealing a dollar and wound up being sentenced as though I had stolen $14,999. Now, there are cases that talk about the sentencing tail wagging the dog, and some of them come out of this circuit. But I would submit to the court that anybody that walked into court for stealing a dollar and got sentenced as though he had stolen nearly $15,000 would consider that sentence patently unreasonable. So, yes.
Well, not if he really had stolen all the money that that was attributed to him as relevant conduct.
Well, that's the beauty and magic of federal sentencing, isn't it? Because when you plead guilty to a case, there's generally an upper limit or a sentence range that reflects reasonably what you pleaded guilty to. And the upper range in federal sentencing is sort of practically limited by the human lifetime because we see all these long, long sentences. I would submit to this court that the standard of review of the sentence is reasonable. That's what we're left with. Is the sentence reasonable? And I would argue vehemently to this court that being sentenced for an offense nearly 15,000 times more serious than the one to which a defendant has pleaded guilty is patently unreasonable. Now, going back to the conflict of interest issue, I think there are a couple things going on in this sentencing. I think it was improper for the government to even talk about or make this proffer about George Taylor. Because, you know, I don't think there was any evidence about that, and I think it was troubling, quite frankly, that Mr. Lake's counsel didn't object to this use of George Taylor at that time to bolster the testimony of these people who really did sock it to him as far as drug quantities are concerned.
But when you look at what the harm was or the prejudice was, I mean, Taylor, we were talking 20 grams attributable to Taylor, right? I mean,
what Taylor attributes directly to Mr. Lake is insignificant.
Exactly.
I agree. It's insignificant.
Right. So when we're trying to weigh this whole conflict situation, we do look at what the harm is, and I guess I have some problem with it, particularly when you look at what the judge ultimately sentenced him
right.
on. This 20 grams then becomes irrelevant. And so, at least in my way of thinking,
well,
I don't see what the prejudice was and if there was a conflict, what the prejudice was.
There was more than just the 20 grams coming from George Taylor, though. What the harm to Mr. Lake was beyond that was George Taylor is used to bolster essentially the estimates that are coming from these guys that really hit them with significant quantities of drugs. The government says, yeah, these estimates are reasonable, and George Taylor was the guy that was in a lot of cases delivering them. So certainly I'm not arguing that 20 grams from George Taylor had any significant effect on the sentence. What I'm arguing, Your Honors, is that using George Taylor to bolster these other significant amounts, you know, hundreds and hundreds of grams of drugs, did have a potential impact on the sentence. And I think at that point, when Platinum Taylor's name came up, something should have happened. And you look at this record, and I look at this record, and I'm troubled that there was not some significant objection to this whole George Platinum Taylor delivery boy argument going on, and a abandonment essentially of any meaningful contest to these drug quantities.
I just have one question about the procedure. This was a phone phone-in procedure with the magistrate judge. Is that typical to do a phone-type hearing and not have a record made without a court reporter?
I'm very worried about that, and I don't know what the practice is. I'm worried about a couple things. Number one, Mr. Lake wasn't there, so he's not hearing about this conflict And he doesn't have a chance to have any input into, oh, my gosh, I don't want this guy to represent me, because he's got some involvement with George Taylor, who's gonna really put it to me when trial comes or when sentencing comes. And I am concerned about the off-the-record thing as well, because I don't really know, and I don't think the record really tells us exactly how much Mr. Lake's attorney knew about what was going on.
And there was not a request by the defense counsel or the prosecutor to put this on the record.
No. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We'll proceed then to hear from Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Anderson. I represent the United States in this matter against Mr. Dion Lake, and I did at trial as well. First of all, before I get to my argument, I do want to address that last question from Judge Williams. Though there's not a court, when we do telephone conferences with the magistrate, as we did in this case addressing the motion filed by Mr. Michalik, there's not a court stenographer taking it, but he does, from his chambers, he records that, tape records that. So if the defense thought there was something in that conversation, in that hearing, they could have asked for a transcript.
So it is recorded.
It is recorded, and a transcript could have been requested if they thought there was something in there. It is the burden of the defense to make a proof of what the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
The existence of that recording docketed somewhere?
I don't recall if it is. I remember seeing the reference to the minutes, the docket entry for the minutes of the hearing, the magistrate indicated, and his ruling on the motion. I think there are docket number 26 and 27. The minute entry is 27. I don't recall, though, if there's a reference to the recording. There may not be, but we know that there is a recording. He says that at the beginning of the conferences. And so it could have been requested. There was nothing essentially, though, however, in that hearing beyond what was in the motion from Mr. Michalik. All the facts of the conflict were expressed in the motion by Mr. Michalik. Nothing more was added. And it was also reflected in the magistrate's findings regarding that hearing. What we have here...
But
is,
we wouldn't have to speculate it if it was part of the minute order or the docket that this was recorded. So it's not a practice, then, I take it, to put it in the record that this is recorded, other than the verbal. Obviously, the magistrate judge says that when the hearing begins. This is
right.
Not anything in the docket, in the court docket sheet is not.
That I can recall, no, but if there were a request for the transcript of the recording, then it would be
done. I understand that, but I'm just saying from a practical standpoint and just good practices, it would be helpful if that were in the docket.
The tape recording were docketed, that probably would be.
Yeah, it says, you know, that hearing held by Magistrate Judge Crocker, hearing recorded, you know, and then go on and give whatever his resolution is. I mean, at least you have some record.
Exactly. Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, sometimes in his orders, I don't recall if this order refers to it, but sometimes in his orders he refers to the fact that the hearing was, the parties were present and it was recorded. Mm-hmm. I don't recall if that specifically says that in this order. Perhaps not. But the point here is the appellant's argument in this case is premised on facts which are simply non-existent here. George Taylor was not a witness. We eliminated any need for Taylor to be a witness. George Taylor's amounts or quantities were not needed for the guideline calculations. And the primary witnesses were Austin Quince and Derek Garrett. Theirs were the quantities which were driving the guideline calculations. And we, based on his initial objections to those individuals, we went to the lengths of adjourning the sentencing hearing, ridding those people out of prison, bringing them to the sentencing hearing, having them sitting in the waiting cells outside at the sentencing hearing, ready to go to testify to their quantities and be cross-examined in any way they could be, until Mr. Lake withdrew his objections at the very last minute. and in withdrawing those objections, accepted the quantities and the calculations in the guideline, in the pre-sentence investigation report, and thereby also, as I noted later in my brief, waiving any argument concerning those quantities. But there is no conflict of interest in this attenuated office-sharing arrangement, and even if there were, counsel's performance was certainly not affected or deficient by that, by any such relationship. While Taylor was a potential co-conspirator, prosecuted a year earlier and represented by attorney Richard Jacobson, he had been sentenced, his appeal was over, counsel's representation of him was over, and more importantly, as I noted, he simply was not going to be a witness, so there was no potential for Lake's counsel to use any privileged information. There was, even in the record, there's no proffer or information that Lake's counsel had any privileged information about Mr. Taylor that he would be conflicted in using.
Well, I understand the chronology, also the office sharing arrangement didn't begin until after Mr. Jacobson's representation of Taylor had
terminated.
Is that right?
Correct. It that began in June of that year. Of the same year that Mr. Lake was being prosecuted, and Mr. Taylor's case was already terminated, and the appeal was over. All of that was completed by that time. Mr. Taylor was simply out of the mix at that point. Lake's argument that somehow impaired his ability to cross-examine the actual witness that we had there, Derek Garrett, there's no support in either the facts in this case or in the law that you would be impaired in cross-examining a third-party witness about someone with whom you even might have a conflict. So there simply was no conflict there. And conflict or not, there was no deficient performance. As this court can clearly see from the record, Lake's argument is that if he had been able to cross-examine Mr. Garrett effectively, it would have called into question Mr. Garrett's estimates. The problem, that being offered as a basis for prejudice against the defendant, is that even without cross-examining Mr. Garrett, that's exactly, he made the argument in his sentencing memorandum that based on the overrepresentation of his criminal history and the inherent estimating nature of these quantities, that the court should exercise its discretion and sentence him at the lower sentencing level. And that, in considering factors under 3553, that's exactly what Judge Crabb did. She made she said, this is a good argument made by your attorney. He's done a good job for you. And I'm going to take these into consideration, your criminal history, and I'm going to take into account the fact, even though the guideline, the pre-sentence report accurately reflects the quantities, and I think they're conservative, still it's estimating, and I'm going to exercise my discretion here and vary from the advisory guideline. He not only received the benefit of that lower range, which is essentially the range he's asking to go back and be resentenced at if we disregard Mr. Garrett's quantities, but she sentenced him at the bottom of that range. So he received benefits in every respect. This is an exemplary case of non-prejudice, non-deficient performance, and no prejudice to the defendant. He got exactly what he had asked for in the sentencing memorandum, which takes us then to the reasonableness of the sentence. There's no procedural error here, so then this court reviews for an abuse of discretion the reasonableness of the sentence. It's clear from the record, as I referred to, the district court gave Lake the opportunity to address the 3553 factors. He did that in his sentencing memorandum effectively, and the judge considered those and then reduced his sentence pursuant to 3553. His argument about the tail wagging the dog on the relevant conduct aspect, well, that even before Booker, this court had considered those arguments repeatedly and rejected those arguments under the guidelines. But post-Booker, this type of an argument has even less force and effect. The district court's not hemmed in or restricted by the guideline sentences, by the guideline sentence use of relevant conduct. And after Booker, the court has discretion to sentence wherever it chooses, weighing or not weighing, counting weights for relevant conduct under 3553. So as I've noted in my brief, as this court has observed in the case of United States versus Reuter, this tail-wagging the dog argument after Booker has effectively, to use another dog analogy, been neutered. Moreover, he can't raise, as I said, he can't raise these challenges now because at the time of sentencing, he withdrew his objections and thereby waived them. So I would ask this court Unless there are any questions, to please affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court. Thank you.
Any further, Mr. String?
Unless the court has any questions, I thank the court for hearing.
Okay. Again, thank you for accepting the appointment in this case, vigorously representing your client.